Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, August 11th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, corruption at Eureka City Hall, alleged by Deputy City Attorney, on his way out the door. So stay tuned. News on that story and more coming right up. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region. With an exclusive interview from former Deputy City Attorney for the City of Eureka, Curtis Davis, and direct feedback from a legal expert who literally wrote the book on local law, reporter Ryan Hudson peels back the layers of Eureka City Hall politics to find what the experts call a red flag and what the fired attorney calls a scandal. Here, Davis warns that under the current structure, Eureka City Manager may have opportunities to sway internal decisions in ways that could raise ethical and legal concerns for the city.
Pulling back the proverbial redwood curtain to include feedback from an outside expert on municipal law and ethics of City Hall dynamics, we'll take a closer look at the controversial firing of a deputy city attorney by Eureka's city manager and a piece of legal advice which former deputy city attorney Curtis Davis says led to his termination by city manager Miles Slattery. We'll hear from an expert on the subject of local law and city attorney ethics, weighing in from Gould School of Law for perspective. Attorney Curtis Davis, who served as deputy city attorney for the City of Eureka from January to June of 2025, asserts that he was fired by the city manager under circumstances that raise questions about potential retaliation as well as the proper exercise of authority within city government. Davis, who was still within his employment probationary period when he got the bad news, believes that his dismissal was directly related to his efforts to uphold ethical standards and legal protocols within the city, and he asserts that the city manager did not have the proper authority to fire a city attorney.
We went out to lunch, and I asked him out to lunch. I went into his office one day, and I told him, hey, you know, we should get to know each other a little better. We went to the, right across from the courthouse, this is the AA. Okay, it's the first time I've been there. We sat down and we ate and we talked about a lot of things. And he told me that once Bob's, temporary tenure had completed, that it was the council's intention and his intention to appoint me as a city attorney. He also in this conversation told me, and he told me this multiple times, that I was his employee. I was his employee. And that struck me as very, very indefensible, because the council appoints the city attorney and the city attorney hires the deputy city attorney, and there's checks and balances built into the charter. You know, that's what our kind of democratic principles it's fundamental to have separation of powers. And the city manager, if that was true, if the city manager, if his employee was the deputy and the city manager had the authority to terminate the deputy city attorney, that would give the city manager such leverage over the city attorney. And there's no way that's consistent with the legal principles and the constitutional legal principles and the democratic legal principles of how a government's organized.
At his own risk, prepared to deal with backlash from his former employer, Davis now contends that the public should know what transpired and what he believes led to his, quote, separation, unquote, from City Hall. With no warning, no prior disciplinary action, and no reason given, Davis explained that on June 6th, he was abruptly fired.
I want to be clear. The city manager, from my view, terminating my employment, he handed me the exit paperwork. He texted me to come into the office, said he had to meet with me, and everything. And so before I get into a specific area of misconduct I raised by the city manager, generally, I think the city manager terminated me because he saw that my ethical principles were to the type that I would not bend to his requests when I determined that those requests were inconsistent with my ethical duties.
You were willing to stand up against him, to him, if needed.
And I did that.
He says that he was summoned to an impromptu afternoon meeting with the city's HR director, where Slattery told Davis, "We're going in a different direction," unquote.
We get to my office and I open the door and I say, "Welcome in, gentlemen, please have a seat." And they both sit down in the two chairs that I have in what's my old office. And then I sit down in my chair behind my desk and I say, "Okay, gentlemen, what's this about?" And the city manager is holding a manila folder, a folder of documents, and it has my name on it, and he says, "We're going a different direction," and he handed me the packet of documents, and I said something to the effect of, like, "Okay, do you want to have a conversation about it? Do you want to talk, can we talk about it?" And the city manager repeated the sentence and said, "We're going a different direction," and I said, "Okay," and I, "Let me just peek at it while I have you here," and I just open it up, and it's kind of the standard stuff. "Okay, so what do you need from me?" "Badge and keys." "Hand that over." "Where's your laptop, Curtis?" I find it on my desk, and "Here you go, here's the charger." "Do you have a city phone?" "Yes." I take that out, and I say, "You know, what else?" And they're like, "Well, you know, you can either do it discreetly over the weekend, or, like, we have boxes if you want to get up and go now." And I did say, "Well, I would like to say something." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Look, sometimes in my position, I have to say things that others are not willing to say." And then the city manager goes, "Thanks for your input." And he gets up and darts out. Okay.
Davis says that his termination was carried out within 48 hours of having issued critical legal advice to the city manager himself in regard to a litigation that the city is currently engaged in. Describing the events leading up to the fateful advice issued to City Manager Miles Slattery, Davis told us,
"And then misconduct I raised. There's a lawsuit that I filed, it's public record, and it's the City of Eureka versus Fusion Smoke and Glass LP, essentially a fraud case, a civil case, for misrepresenting to the public and the city that the smoke shop would only sell the types of items that the license allowed. But they misrepresented that and they sold other products that the license did not allow, including unlawfully selling products to minors. Long story short, some witnesses came forward. Some witnesses walked into City Hall. So they walked into City Hall and I confirmed they're not represented. And long story short, I interview this witness. And I determined after my interview that it's a key witness in the case. Key witness. Mm-hmm. And the city manager then wants to contact the witness. And I, because it's my license on the line and I have ethical duties to the city, I tried to reach out to the city manager. I called him. He didn't call me back. I called Bob Black. He didn't call me back. That's problematic that mm-hmm. a city manager wants to contact a key witness in an active lawsuit filed by the city. Mm-hmm. That will not put the city in a strong or a good position in the litigation because the defense attorneys will easily be able to argue that, look, the city is unethically and unlawfully, perhaps, abusing its power by influencing these witnesses, by directly contacting them. And so I put out a communication, an email to the city with the other departments involved, copied, that just put people on notice that any contact any city staff have with a witness implicates them as a witness and potentially interferes with the city attorney office's investigation. And I recommended that anyone who had the intention to reach out to that individual who is a key witness in the case come and discuss that intention with our office first. Okay. And I believe that that email, in response to the city manager requesting the contact information of the individual, resulted in my termination because I believe partly resulted in my termination in combination with the other things I've mentioned because I believe the city manager saw that as a direct undermining of his authority. And my position is, no, I have ethical duty to the city, to my client, to protect the integrity of the case and to protect my investigation.
Then, within 48 hours, Davis had been terminated. Attorney Michael Jenkins, lecturer in law at University of Southern California Gould School of Law, whose expertise is in the area of municipal local law, provided several key insights related to Davis's situation.
I think in this instance, it's not appropriate for the city manager to want to speak to a witness in a case being handled by the city attorney's office. Really plays no role in that sort of litigation. Litigation is handled by the city attorney's office. It'd be very unusual to have a city manager wanting to speak to a witness in that case. It is unusual. Raises questions.
Jenkins sided with Davis on the issue of advising against possible witness tampering by the city manager, telling us over the phone in an interview,
"No city attorney would want the city manager to have an interview with a witness in a case that is being handled by the city attorney without understanding why the manager wants that conversation. What's in it? What's it for? What's the deal? And the city manager's role is not to handle litigation. It's not the city manager's job. You look at this code, the municipal code of the city of Eureka, and in the first title or two of the code, there'll be a chapter that says duties of the city manager. None of them indicate handling litigation. That is a red flag."
As to the witness in question possibly having been contacted by Eureka City Manager Miles Slattery, Jenkins found the scenario concerning.
"And any city attorney worth their salt would say the same thing. Why do you want to talk to this witness? What is it you intend to say to this witness? This is my case, my witness. What's going on?" And it is, of course, very important for the city attorney and city manager to work as a team. You know, it's a collaborative government, a city government. Everybody has to be on the same team, working towards the same objective. And if there are issues or disagreements, then they have to be worked out. But that seems highly unusual behavior on the part of the city manager. Okay?
Yeah.
Not knowing anything more about it, you know, I would ask the question, why? And if the city attorney thinks that the city manager's up to no good, then the city attorney has a duty to report that to the city council.
Offering a hypothetical, Jenkins explained.
The city attorney cannot publicly disclose confidential information. So when they bring wrongdoing to the attention of the highest decision-making body in the city, and then this highest decision-making body does not cure the wrongdoing, the city attorney is basically obligated to resign. That's their only choice. They're obligated to resign.
But in Davis's case, he'd never had that chance. He was fired within 48 hours of issuing his warning before any determination could be made by the interim city attorney or the council, and before it was clear whether his advice would be followed or rejected.
It's not common for the city attorney or even the deputy city attorney to work for and to be subject to being fired by the city manager. Every city, of course, is different, and it's not illegal for that to be the setup. The prevailing practice is that the city attorney works for the city council and is hired and fired only by the city council. Now, I'm not saying that that's a rule of thumb that every city has to adhere to, but it is the prevailing practice. No city attorney is comfortable working for and being subject to being fired by the city manager. Typically, the city attorney and the city manager are co-equals, both hired and fired by the city council. But as I say, that could be different in the city of Eureka. And it's entirely possible that a deputy city attorney is employed by the city manager or is fireable by the city manager. It happens. I've seen it in some cities. So it wouldn't be illegal. There's nothing wrong with it, but it has to provide that someplace.
The deputy attorney position is not specifically outlined within the Eureka City Charter or in the city's personnel rules and regulations. In a thorough review of each publicly available document, there is no specific mention of who is responsible for firing the deputy city attorney apart from a provision directing the council to administer the office of city attorney. The charter does explain that the city council is in charge of hiring and firing the city attorney. City manager Miles Slattery did confirm by email that the deputy city attorney position is not outlined in the charter or in the personnel rules and regulations, noting that the position is only described on the city's website. There, the position is explained as being under the supervision and direction of the city attorney's office. Nowhere is it stated within the charter or personnel rules that the city manager has the power to terminate a city attorney or a deputy city attorney. In regard to his assertion that the Eureka City Manager's office has overstepped boundaries at City Hall, Attorney Curtis Davis explained that it is not in the city's best interest to allow what he says is an unethical abuse of power.
Because the city attorney needs to have autonomy from the city manager, because the city attorney has ethical duties to the city, the one client. So if the city manager had the ability to fire the deputy city attorney, that would give the city manager so much influence and the ability to interfere with the city attorney, complying with the city attorney's ethical duties and the deputy city attorney's ethical duties to represent effectively the city. The city clerk bends to the will of the city manager, and in my opinion, the city attorney does the same. So, and Miles also, he fired me because he wanted to set an example of me to all City Hall, that if you don't go along with what I want, you're out.
Eureka City Manager Miles Slattery confirms he is unable to provide feedback due to this being a personnel matter, and also had no comment as to whether or not he did in fact contact the witness in the Fusion Smoke case.
The city government has a major influence on the community's ability to be safe, to grow, and to respond to its needs. And the city is operating in unlawful ways that are prohibiting the public from that benefit, is depriving the public of resources, of opportunity, and of safety.
Now, the former deputy city attorney is thinking of legal action against the city, potentially citing employer retaliation and unlawful termination labor code violations, an area of law that he considers a forte in his private practice. For KMUD News, I'm Ryan Hudson. To see the full two-part article on this story, you can go to Redheaded Black Belt at kimkemp.com.
In state news, Gavin Newsom and Pelosi join Texas Democrats in Sacramento as governor plans November ballot measure to counter Texas redistricting. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The Texas redistricting war continues to escalate in the Texas legislature and back home in California. In Austin, Texas, the State House of Representatives gaveled into session Friday for a scheduled vote on the Republican redistricting plan. 8 minutes and 6 seconds later, it adjourned without a vote.
Members, may I have your attention? The roll has been called and a quorum has not been established.
Republican House Speaker Dustin Burroughs announced some new actions, like no longer depositing pay for the Democrats who went to other states to block a quorum. Instead, they'll have to pick up their paychecks in person. Burroughs says they're also exploring other actions to compel a quorum.
Each one of you knows that eventually you will come back, and we will pass the priorities of the special session on the call. But with each passing day, the political cost of your absence is rising, and it will be paid in full.
But that does not seem to be stopping the Texas Democrats, like Congressmember Ann Johnson.
We are now facing threats. The threat that we're going to lose our jobs, the threat of financial ruin, the threat that we be hunted down as our colleagues sit on their hands and remain silent as we all get personal threats to our lives.
She says the Texas Democrats see the danger that is coming and they're running straight for it.
We are running from nothing. We are running to the front lines. We are running to the front lines to stand with other Democrats across the state of Texas, across the state of California, across this nation, to ensure that each and every individual has the opportunity to pick, to decide that government is for the people, by the people, and not the politicians selecting them. And so we are here because we do know that courage is contagious. And we are here to give hope to others to stand up and be courageous in this moment.
Johnson, along with other Texas Democrats, were speaking in Sacramento, where they were hosted by Governor Gavin Newsom, who's planning to counter Texas' redistricting plan with California redistricting.
The President of the United States of America, Donald Trump, who's trying to light a torch on democracy. He's trying to roll back the last half century. He wants to put America in reverse on LGBT rights, on voting rights, civil rights, on the rights of women and girls. We're here in that light at this profound and consequential moment.
Newsom's plan would put a measure on the November ballot to redraw California's congressional map to counter Texas' move. House Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi is on board with that.
So this isn't two wrongs, or as was mentioned. It's not a wrong in what we're doing. This is self-defense for our democracy. They have stricken, they have hit out at our democracy, and we are here to defend it.
Other states, both red and blue, are also considering redrawing their congressional maps now. But the two big players with multiple House seats in play are Texas and California. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In national news, Palestinians fearful of Israel plans to take over Gaza City as part of escalation to take over nearly the entire Gaza Strip. In Gaza for KPFA, Rami Almagari reports.
Here at the Al Rimal UNRWA run prep school for girls in western Gaza City, hundreds of displaced Palestinians from northern Gaza City seem shocked over the latest Israeli decision to take over Gaza City. Many of them have been displaced for multiple times since the war began nearly 2 years ago. Ghazala is a displaced mother of two boys, her husband in a wheelchair from a back injury.
We are frightened, especially since we have little children. My husband's electric wheelchair is broken as its batteries have run out. Likely, we won't be able to help him flee, as we can walk, but he can't. We do not have a regular wheelchair. When we were displaced from Beit Hanun, we brought him a donkey carriage. But for now, we have no clue as to what to do. Only God knows.
Muhammad is another displaced Palestinian from the same shelter school. A single man in his 30s, he has suffered from injuries and displacement for multiple times. He expresses frustration.
My message to the world is, help stop this war, this catastrophic war. My message to negotiators, they have to concede everything for the sake of the residents, not for the cause that has already faded away, and not for Jerusalem, which has a God to protect. Palestinian negotiators, who are supposed to be Palestinians, should concede everything for the sake of the Palestinian citizens.
At the political level, the Islamist Hamas party called Israel's latest military escalation into Gaza City a coup against the mediated negotiations process. In the meantime, efforts by mediators are underway. Dr. Raed Najm is a Gaza-based political analyst.
Mediators are exerting efforts to contain this situation. They are trying to convince Hamas to reverse their positions and show flexibility in order to reach a temporary truce, separate from outstanding issues including the disarmament of Hamas or leaving the governance of Gaza. There are some indicators that Hamas could show flexibility, but it's unclear due to the fact that Hamas is siding with the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood group, which has criticized Egypt's mediator.
The new Israeli plan involves an Israeli army takeover of almost the entire Gaza Strip, and establishing a civil administration in Gaza run by Israel and forcing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians by October 7 this year south in the coastal enclave. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Almighari in Gaza.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reports.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says he wants to improve Indigenous people's access to traditional foods. Standing outside a tribal health center in Fairbanks, Alaska, Kennedy told reporters last week he's collecting ideas, but is not exactly sure how to achieve that goal.
I'm trying to figure out ways I can use my agency and my relationships with the other secretaries to return those foods.
Kennedy made a few stops at healthcare facilities in the state. In Anchorage, he went so far as to call processed foods' impact on Native health part of a, quote, genocide. The center where Kennedy spoke in Fairbanks is operated by Tanana Chiefs Conference, or TCC. The nonprofit tribal organization aims to support health and social service needs of its 42 members, 37 of which are federally recognized tribes. TCC Chief Brian Ridley says the secretary's pledge is just a starting point, but encouraging.
He seems totally on board with working with us, trying to do what we can in those areas to try to get back to our traditional foods so that they're healthier. And it's just a matter of working with him and the senators going forward on trying to find a way to actually make that happen.
The press event took place after Kennedy toured the health center with Alaska's U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan. Light Up Navajo is an annual aid program meant to help electrify rural and remote households across the Navajo Nation, the largest reservation in the U.S. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the project reached a major milestone earlier this month.
With help from nearly four dozen public and private utilities spanning 20 states, the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, or NTUA, says volunteers installed 41 miles of power lines and hooked up 196 homes this year alone, now surpassing 1,000 dwellings in all. Typically conducted over the summer months, Light Up Navajo began as a six-week pilot in 2019 between NTUA and the American Public Power Association. 6 years later, it's now a 14-week endeavor. NTUA estimates about 10,000 households are still in the dark. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
A nonprofit in New Mexico that supports Native American communities wants Congress to restore funding for an employment and training program. KUNM's Jeanette Didios has more.
Among ongoing federal funding cuts, the Native Professional Advancement Center is urging Congress to reverse a budget proposal that would eliminate money for Native workforce training programs. The center's board chair, Lorraine Edmo, recently sent a letter to Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro, a ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee, requesting action to restore $60 million. Executive Director of the Center, Darius Lee, says the elimination of federal funding, quote, undermines decades of progress and violates the government's responsibility to honor tribal sovereignty. According to a press release by the organization, the federal budget proposal by the Trump administration is calling for the elimination of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and instead creating a new state-controlled block grant called Make America Skilled Again. If created, it would cut tribes and nonprofits from direct access to workforce resources, force tribes to compete with the state for funding, and shut down culturally specific support systems that have helped Native people earn employment. The House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to possibly take another vote on this portion of the budget on September 2nd. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Ryan Hudson, Christopher Martinez, Rami Almagari, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pendulinen.